Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Paul Kavika Martin of Peace Action, who assesses the significance of the U.S. Senate's passage of the Yemen War Powers Resolution, and how the vote could exert pressure on the Trump administration and the Saudis to end their bloody war in Yemen. Poe Murray, chair of Newtown Action Alliance, who discusses the recent Connecticut Supreme Court ruling that reinstates a wrongful death lawsuit against gunmaker Remington Arms for the 2012 Sandy Hook Elementary School massacre. And Kara Ortoliva, lead organizer with the Youth Climate Strike in Connecticut, who talks about the demands of the worldwide youth-led movement pressing government leaders for urgent action on climate change. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
The United Arab Emirates, or UAE, is looking to flex its military muscle in the Persian Gulf and the greater Middle East. Today, Dubai is mostly known for its glitzy skyscrapers, but the kingdom's leaders are looking to establish a powerful presence in a volatile region. With only 1 million people, the UAE has expanded its arms industry and attracted lots of buyers. Former U.S. Defense Secretary James Mattis called the small Gulf nation Little Sparta for its growing military clout. After the end of the Cold War, the UAE had a small army, relying on aging equipment and foreign commanders. But amidst shifting political alliances, the Arab Spring, and growing fears of Iran, Crown Prince Mohammed bin Zayed embarked on a plan to modernize the UAE's armed forces, purchasing advanced weapons systems from France and the U.S. According to the Christian Science Monitor, the UAE's military in recent years has enforced the no-fly zone in Libya and sent fighters into Syria to battle Islamic State insurgents. In the Saudi-led, U.S.-backed Yemen war, UAE forces have played a central role in daily missions battling Houthi rebels. However, the Saudi-UAE war in Yemen has been widely condemned for triggering the world's most serious humanitarian crisis, a conflict that has become so divisive the GOP-controlled U.S. Senate recently voted to end American military involvement in Yemen and to curtail President Trump's war powers. Through the early days of the 2020 presidential campaign, Democrats were repeatedly asked about reparations to compensate African Americans for slavery and decades of racism. Several candidates, including Elizabeth Warren and Julian Castro, back reparations without offering a specific plan. When asked about reparations at a CNN forum, Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders explained he co-sponsored a bill with Congressman Jim Clyburn to mobilize federal resources in distressed communities. When pressed about reparations by CNN host Wolf Blitzer, Sanders responded by asking, "What does that mean? I don't think anyone's been very clear." The Intercept, which has promoted debate over reparations, says Sanders makes an important point since the agenda for reparations is not very specific. Unlike Medicare for All, reparations are often viewed as a broad progressive value, not a specific policy. Other candidates, including Cory Booker and Kamala Harris, support broad initiatives to support the poor, which is comprised disproportionately by people of color. But neither of the two announced black candidates are pushing race-specific strategies to counter the legacy of slavery and systemic racism. Calls for reparations were ignored in the civil rights era in the 1960s and during the presidency of Barack Obama, the nation's first black president. Expectations were high that public sector unions would collapse after the U.S. Supreme Court ruled that workers could opt out of fair share fees to pay for collective bargaining. Months after the historic ruling, public sector unions were doing better than expected, with minimal loss of membership, as union leaders rallied their rank-and-file members. According to In These Times, public favorability of labor unions is at a 15-year high. At major unions like AFSCME and the American Federation of Teachers, workers are signing on as members at 5 times the rate they are opting out. In Los Angeles, the AFT Local launched a major outreach campaign focusing on teachers, talking up the benefits of collective action. Opposing the Janus decision was seen as a key strategy to defend public education and counter the rise of charter and private schools. In many states, public sector unions are under attack from the same right-wing groups who developed the Janus case. These groups organized aggressive campaigns via email and knocking on doors to convince workers to opt out of unions. Unions say the effort by groups like the Freedom Foundation backfired. Among home care providers in Oregon, new union membership outpaced those opting out by a 3-2 margin. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Elaine Osowski.
The U.S. Senate, by a 54-46 vote, approved a resolution calling for an end to U.S. support for the Saudi Arabia-led coalition war in Yemen. Voting for the measure on March 13th were all Senate Democrats, joined by 7 Republicans, which put President Trump on notice of growing opposition to the U.S. role in the war, which the United Nations calls the world's most dire humanitarian crisis. 14 million Yemeni civilians are now on the brink of starvation as the nation faces a devastating cholera epidemic. The Senate had approved the War Powers Resolution last December, but the GOP-controlled House blocked a vote at that time. Democrats, who won control of the House in November, passed their own version of the resolution in February. But due to a procedural issue, the House must vote again using the Senate measure's language. President Trump has vowed to veto the legislation, which would require a 2/3 majority vote in both houses of Congress to override. If the vote proceeds as expected, this would be the first time the War Powers Act has been invoked by Congress since the legislation won passage in 1973. Your reporter spoke with Paul Kavika Martin, Senior Director for Policy and Political Affairs with Peace Action. Here, Martin assesses the significance of the Senate's passage of the War Powers Act and growing animosity toward the Saudi monarchy after they murdered Washington Post columnist Jamal Khashoggi, which could exert pressure on the Trump administration and the Saudis to end their bloody war in Yemen.
We've been attempting to do this for a number of years, and in the House, at least the last couple of years, the war powers kept getting blocked by Republican leadership using various methods to take what should be a privileged resolution to be able to force a vote on these war issues and deprivilege them and doing other tactics to not have votes. But fortunately, now that we have a Democratic-controlled House, they have moved forward with the vote earlier this year, in which we would hope that the Senate vote would actually send the bill to the president's desk. Unfortunately, the Republicans use another tactic to the House version this year, which is something called a motion to recommit. It's like the last chance for the minority party to offer either an alternative or a slight change in the bill. And the Democrats at the time didn't know that this motion, which was specifically a motion to support Israel and to oppose anti-Semitism, which, of course, you know, most people want to support, be opposed to anti-Semitism. So it was sort of an easy vote, but the Democrats didn't quite realize that what's going to do that the Senate parliamentarian would rule that it would make it was not quite related to the bill and lost the privilege status on the Senate side. So McConnell couldn't bring up the bill. Decided he didn't want to bring up the bill on the House side. So we're doing this one more time, hopefully, and this was the vote, as you mentioned, in the Senate is a new bill from the War Powers Resolution, very similar to the one that passed last December. Now that it has passed, with all Democrats voting for it and a couple of Republicans helping out, Collins from Maine, Daines from Montana, Lee from Utah, Moran from Kansas, Murkowski from Alaska, and Paul from Kentucky, and Young from Indiana. And so now it goes one more time to the House, and this time we hope that House members will understand that if we want to send this to the president's desk, it needs to be a clean bill, no amendments, no supporting any motions to recommit, just send it to the president's desk and see what the president does with it.
The outcome that is likely here is that
President Trump will veto this bill unless there were a two-thirds majority in the House and Senate to override his veto. Is that the likely course of events here?
Yeah, I believe so. I believe that the House will pass it and that it will get sent to the president's desk several times. He has threatened to veto it. So it's very likely that the veto will occur. And while that's, you know, disheartening not to see this actually enacted into law, and what basically what the law would do would stop the U.S. support of the Saudi-led coalition war on Yemen. We have been providing, historically, we're providing refueling of jets under pressure. Trump administration did stop that late last year, but we still provide targeting assistance, possible arms sales. We have people on the ground in, not only in Yemen, but in Saudi Arabia assisting with the war. It would stop this assistance. Even though it's not going to be signed into law, we've heard from high-level negotiators in the peace process in the Yemen civil war that these votes and this pressure that's being put on Saudi Arabia is impacting the negotiations in a positive way to move towards a political solution, because that's the only solution that we have here to stop this war. And so we do think that another vote and the attention that the veto will get will continue to put pressure on the Saudi-led coalition to end the war, as well as the rebels inside Yemen. And lastly, it does provide strength to the Congress to move forward on other possible avenues, such as trying to cut off funding for things and other legislative activities that they can do over the next several months. So when you have so many millions of people on the edge of starvation, it's one of the hopes that these votes and the attention that is being put on the situation will put pressure on the parties to work quicker to come to some sort of political agreement. We do know, again, from very high-level people within the negotiating teams that these votes will, they think, will help put pressure to get that political solution, which is the only way to stop the war.
That was Paul Kavika Martin, Senior Director for Policy and Political Affairs with Peace Action. For more perspectives on the U.S. role in the Yemen war and the War Powers Act, visit our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. On March 14th, the Connecticut Supreme Court handed down a ruling that reinstates a wrongful death lawsuit filed by families of victims of the Sandy Hook Elementary School shooting against Remington Arms, the manufacturer of the rifle used in the December 14, 2012 massacre. In their 4-3 ruling, the justices overturned a lower court decision that the lawsuit was prohibited by a 2005 federal law that shields gun makers from liability in most cases when their products are used in crimes. The plaintiffs, who include a survivor and relatives of 9 people killed in the Sandy Hook massacre, argued that the AR-15-style Bushmaster rifle sold by Remington and used by shooter Adam Lanza was irresponsibly marketed and promoted to civilians to carry out offensive military-style combat missions against their perceived enemies. The gunmaker used slogans in their advertising, such as "Consider Your Man Card Reissued." Your reporter spoke with Poe Murray, chair of the Newtown Action Alliance, established after the Sandy Hook massacre in her city, who assesses the significance of the ruling handed down by the Connecticut Supreme Court, but first reflects on the March 15th mass shooting in New Zealand, where a white supremacist used a semi-automatic rifle to shoot and kill 50 worshippers at 2 mosques.
You know, the shooting obviously is very similar to many of the tragic incidents that occur in America, and our hearts go out to their community because we know firsthand, you know, what they're going through right now. And, you know, we truly appreciate the fact that their government has vowed to take swift action to change our gun laws. And, you know, we are watching very closely the way they are handling this mass tragedy. The Prime Minister has said that she would support the families that have been impacted by this, you know, horrendous act of terrorism and violence. And we truly appreciate seeing that type of leadership because we don't have that in America.
Poe, I wanted to turn to local issues here. And I wondered if you would comment for our listeners on the Connecticut Supreme Court ruling, which was handed down March 14th, that reinstated a wrongful death lawsuit filed by families of 9 victims of the Sandy Hook Elementary School shooting, that lawsuit against Remington Arms, the manufacturer of the rifle used in the December 14th, 2012 massacre of 26 and 7-year-old children and 6 educators at Sandy Hook Elementary School in Newtown, where you are.
Yeah, we are extremely grateful that the Connecticut Supreme Court ruled in favor of the Sandy Hook family because they certainly deserve their day in court to seek some justice. And hopefully this ruling would be far-reaching. We're hoping that other states could use their own unfair trade practice laws to come to the same conclusion that our Supreme Court did and give the families of victims of gun violence and all the states their day in court as well. But even if that does not happen, the discovery phase of the case will be extremely helpful to expose the gun sellers and reckless and deceptive marketing and distribution and sales strategies of their very, very lethal weapons for all these years. As we are all aware, the discovery phase of the lawsuits against the tobacco industry helped to turn the public sentiment, and it forced more accountability from big tobacco. And we hope that this is a step in the right direction to topple the NRA, the NSSS, and other bad actors.
Poe, can you talk a bit about the focus of this case, which was on the marketing of these weapons of war to civilian buyers here in the United States, with particular attention to some of the slogans that appeared in many of the ads for guns like the Bushmaster, the AR-15 that was used in the Sandy Hook shooting?
Yeah, so while the NRA and the National Shooting Sports Foundation, which is headquartered right here in Newtown, they claim that AR-15s and other weapons, lethal weapons, are not assault weapons. But at the same time, I have seen, the advertisements for these type of lethal weapons. They market them as weapons of war, and that, you will get a man card if you own such a gun. It would be great to be able to look into their marketing strategies to see if, in fact, they have used these deceptive and reckless marketing strategies to put these guns in the hands of very dangerous human beings.
Do you think in the long run this Connecticut Supreme Court ruling will have any impact on the 2005 federal law that immunizes gun manufacturers from civil liability lawsuits brought by victims of gun violence? Because that certainly, this ruling actually targets what could be termed a loophole in that broad federal immunity to gun manufacturers.
Right, that's right. Yeah. So in 2005, Congress passed the Protection of Lawful Commerce and Arms Act called PLACTA. And it really was an unprecedented bill that generally protected the guns industry from a majority of lawsuits with, several exceptions. It sent a chilling effect for the families and victims. I'll give you an example. One of my good friends, Sandy Amani Phillips, they lost their daughter, Jessie, in the Aurora Theater shooting in 2012, and they decided to sue the online ammunition dealer called the Lucky Gunner that armed their daughter's killer in Aurora. The gunman was able to purchase more than 4,000 rounds of ammunition before the shooting spree without a background check, no questions asked. So they decided to sue the company, and the judge dismissed the case based on that PLACTA law. And the family Sandy and Lonnie were forced to pay more than $200,000 in legal fees to the defendants in accordance with the law. So Sandy and Lonnie were forced to file for bankruptcy. And, you know, all they wanted to do was to hold them, you know, accountable for what they did and to, you know, reduce the deceptive actions of, you know, these dealers. And it's just tragic to watch families who lost their loved ones being, you know, victimized again by this horrific law that, you know, protects the gun industry. But we are pushing Congress to take action. And in January, Representative Dwight Evans introduced a bill, H.R. 157, called the Gun Manufacturers Accountability Act, and that will repeal the FACA, you know, provisions. And before this year, Representative Adam Schiff and Senator, our own Senator Richard Blumenthal, they introduced bills in the 115th Congress to repeal PLACA, and we hope that they will, you know, join our efforts to repeal this terrible law that do nothing to protect these families and our children from gun violence.
That was Poe Murray, chair of Newtown Action Alliance. Find more analysis and commentary on the significance of the Connecticut Supreme Court ruling in the Sandy Hook lawsuit by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. On March 15th, more than a million students walked out of classrooms around the world, calling for emergency action to respond to the climate crisis. They took their cue from teenage Swedish activist Greta Thunberg, who began a one-person school strike last year, protesting every Friday outside the Parliament building in Stockholm. She has since spoken to world leaders in several venues, stating plainly what's at stake for her generation and trying to shame them into action. The statewide event in Connecticut took place outside the Capitol building in Hartford, featuring mostly youth activist speakers, Black, white, and Latinx, who promoted generational, class, and racial climate justice. They talked, for example, about the need to reduce toxic pollution from fossil-fueled power plants that affect low-income people and people of color the most. Several of the young people interviewed said their parents and school officials weren't crazy about the school strike, but many parents ultimately supported their children, and some joined them at the strike rally. After the speeches, participants lined up on both sides of Capitol Avenue with banners and signs, where they chanted and drew supportive horn honks and thumbs up from passing cars. Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhus was at the strike rally in Hartford and spoke with Kira Ortoliva, a senior at a suburban New Haven high school and lead organizer with the state's youth climate strike. Here she explains the climate strike's demands and next steps in the campaign for climate action.
We are calling for the Green New Deal. We're calling for legislative action. Having all of these strikes all over the world, all over countries, we hope that the world leaders will take a look at us and hear what we're saying.
You listed when you spoke before a lot of demands that I would love for you to be able to share as many as you can without any notes right now, if you can.
So we're calling for the Green New Deal. We want to end all infrastructure projects for fossil fuel. We want to keep our water supply clean. We want to preserve wildlife and public land as well. And we want a healthy transition from fossil fuels to renewable energy as well.
You know, the Green New Deal bill was introduced the first day of this session, but it was just a placeholder. There's nothing in it. So people are talking about what should be in it. And all those demands you just mentioned, do you think they should all be in it?
Absolutely. I think the Green New Deal should be the first step into tackling climate change head on, because we are at the point in our lives where it's becoming a very serious problem. And by 2040, there will be more plastic in the ocean than fish.
So this is a pretty lively demonstration, and I think people did say they were going to be at some point maybe lobbying members of the legislature here. What other kinds of actions do you think are necessary in terms of dealing with, you know, that are commensurate with the level of the problem?
So what we can do is economics. Economics is a big part in this because we as citizens, we are consumers, and we buy from the companies who are contributing the biggest to climate change. Now, these companies such as Quaker Oats, Charmin, Exxon, all of these companies, mostly gas companies as well, they're fracking, they're contributing to deforestation, and they're taking away animals' homes. And it's one of the leading causes in why some animals are going extinct and endangered. So changing your lifestyle is a very, very big way to help climate change.
And what do you mean by that?
Well, we as Americans, we have an everyday thing where, you know, we go to Dunkin'. Dunkin' has a saying, America runs on Dunkin'. Now, the unfortunate part about it is that some people will go to recycle their Dunkin' cups. Now, this is just an example, but you cannot actually recycle the lids and the straws of the Dunkin' cups, and they need to be washed out before they are recycled. And a lot of people don't understand this, and this is what causes the problems in recycling companies, because if there's any piece of food in your recycling bin, it contaminates the entire bin. And a lot of people don't understand or know that.
So what would you say is the next step after this? And you're probably going to be, as soon as you get a chance, checking on how things have gone all over the country, right?
Yes, absolutely. I'll be hopping onto my National Shames group chat in a bit. But the first step that we're going to take after this strike is my co-leads and I, and anyone who would like to join to support, we're going to be lobbying some bills, and we're going to try and put them in motion, as well as the Green New Deal. And our next U.S. Youth Climate Strike will be held on May 3rd.
That was Kira Ortoliva, lead organizer with the Youth Climate Strike in Connecticut. Learn more about the youth-led movement and its demands by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines through our mobile-friendly website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archive programs in MP3 and streaming audio, and support our show. There you can also subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Follow us on Facebook at Between the Lines Radio News Magazine and on Twitter at BTL Radio News. Thanks for listening on WOZO in Knoxville, Tennessee, KHOI in Ames, Iowa, KGHI in Westport, Washington, and dozens of other community stations across the U.S. and abroad. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Susan Bramhall, Mary Hunt, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Elaine Osowski, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris.